Slavery is back.
Welcome to a place where private business profit from a captive labour force, yet pennies are spent on medical services to a population in which the Indigenous, the poor and the mentally ill are overrepresented. Where isolation, humiliation and degradation are facts of life. Welcome to prison.
It depends who's telling the story, I suppose. The prisoners would have one view. The people who work in the prison system would have another. And I think it's up to people to decide where the truth is.
Give government propaganda and the media spin doctors the flick. And check out Doin' Time for news, views and tunes on prison issues from Guantanamo Bay to Christmas Island to prisons and detention centres everywhere. Every Monday at 4 p.m. on your community radio, 3CR.
We are still fired up and we're still talking about revolution.
Hello and welcome to the Doin' Time Show. This is 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM on the dial, streaming live on www.3cr.org.au. And a warning that this episode of Doin' Time contains audio descriptions of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who have died, discussion of deaths in custody and massacres. And this is Marissa and I'll be with you for the next hour. On today's show, we will first hear from Ian Rintel from the Refugee Action Coalition, who will provide an update about what's happening with the asylum seeker and refugee policies in regards to deportation. So specifically, we'll be looking at what's happening with the Iranian asylum seeker who may be deported. And I usually invite Ian on really to give us regular updates about what's been happening with refugees and asylum seekers. We'll also talk about the background to the war in Iran and speak also about a latest media release where there have been some shocking arrests in Queensland for using the pro-Palestine slogan, from the river to the sea. Hello, Ian. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Marissa.
Hi. Now, do you want to just start off, you know, and talk a little bit about what's been happening?
Yeah, well, I thought I could start with the issue about the Iranian soccer team, actually, because I think it exposes the hypocrisy of the Australian government rather drastically.
Indeed.
People will be aware of the general story and the fact that some people have, some of the soccer players themselves have, changed their mind, subsequently and, for better or worse, going back to Iran. But I think behind all the very positive media that Tony Burke and the Labor Party tried to claim for themselves and their generous attitude to the soccer players, and, of course, we support the idea that the soccer players should have been able to claim, asylum, as easily as they turned out to. But the reality is that almost immediately after the very stage-managed photographs of Tony Burke with the Iranian asylum seekers, the government itself introduced legislation that prevents other people coming from Iran, allows the government to prevent other people coming from Iran to claim asylum. So it's just astonishing hypocrisy, on the one hand, to try to claim international praise for their attitude to the soccer players. Mm. But at the same time, really just slam the door in the face of the prospect that anyone else might be able to come from, Iran, and despite the fact that they might be in similar circumstances to claim, asylum in Australia. So it was pretty astounding, I think, for anyone who, is paying closer attention to what the Australian government attitudes fundamentally are to, asylum, and that is they keep the door as tightly closed as they possibly can, including places where they are directly involved in creating, refugees, as they are at the moment, supporting the bombing in Iran.
Yeah, look, it really is quite draconian at the moment, isn't it, Ian?
Yeah, look, it is pretty astounding, actually, and, we've raised the other issues. So there are 82 Iranians that are still in closed detention in Australia, the Iranian refugees in PNG, you know, they still haven't been able to go to Canada, the US, New Zealand, you know, let alone Australia. There are Iranians who are in the community who are still on bridging visas, waiting to get permanent visas. Just before the bombing started, the government tried to send someone back to Iran. The guy's presently in, you know, Villawood Detention Centre, but they tried to cancel his visa and send him, you know, back to Iran. Like, the contradictions in the government's position is really, you know, quite astounding. So we say yes to the soccer players, but it should be yes to all the people from Iran who need protection in Australia.
Absolutely. I know this is something you don't need to answer if you don't wish to, but I'm wondering, in terms of what happened with the person, with what happened at Bondi.
Yes.
Is he being deported?
No, I don't think there'll be any. They'll want to go through the whole trial.
Yeah, because he failed the character test, evidently.
Of course he would, absolutely, yes. Yeah, no, they'll want to go through with the trial. They will jail him, but certainly, I don't know exactly what visa he's on, but he would certainly fail the character test. He's more likely to find himself on Nauru.
Oh, right. The one that helped people on Bondi Beach.
Oh, not the one who helped. No, I don't know about his situation at all. Most of the one who.
That's
helped.
Okay. We'll talk about that off air. It is. Yeah. That's why I was saying you may not have been in a position to answer that question.
I don't know about that one.
Very brief. We'll talk about it later. But very interesting. But getting back to what's happening, Ian. So yes to the soccer players. Okay, there's nothing wrong with that. But really looking at, there just seems to be some policies which is a severe violation of human rights.
Yeah, look, and that's really what underpins the Australian government's position. The fact is, like, the Bill Wheeler family, who was, one of the, when Labor was elected in 2022, the big publicity, flowers delivered to the Bill Wheeler family, a permanent visa for the Bill Wheeler family, but the thousands of others who were on bridging visas in exactly the same circumstances, got nothing until, late last year. And I think we're seeing a similar thing, flowers and publicity photos with Iranian soccer players, but the reality, in terms of Australian government policy, is that the door is very, firmly shut. Look, I just happen to know that, there's another mother of an Iranian who was just having a baby, and mother was had a visa to come in to assist her with the birth and looking after the kid in the first few months after the birth. That visa was cancelled on arrival, and she was returned to Iran just before the bombing, about a week or so before the bombing. And that really exemplifies the reality of the Australian government's attitude to people who are coming from places like Iran or Iraq. If you're coming from Afghanistan or Indonesia or Myanmar, you can forget about it. I mean, you're not even going to get a visa in the first place. But the policy is based on excluding people, and the legislation that was introduced after the soccer players were given asylum, just as as the icing on the cake, that to have such sweeping legislation that allows the government to cancel the visas of anyone who maybe, even if they're already granted, be able to come to Australia if the circumstances in that country changes and it means they're likely to claim asylum. I mean, the reality is you can look at every sporting event that's really happened since 1956, when the Hungarians got asylum, after the Russia invaded Hungary in 1956. The Olympics were in Melbourne. Some of the Hungarians got protection visas, got asylum in Australia. Then every sporting event since then has meant, whether it's Iranians, whether it's been Sudanese or people from other countries, where there's political persecution, have been able to claim asylum in Australia. The government now has given themselves the capacity to cancel the visas of anyone who they vaguely suspect might be able to or might be inclined to claim asylum when they come to Australia, and they really think it's that kind of hypocrisy which needs to be exposed. We've seen lots of photos of Tony Burke with soccer players. How about we see a lot more media coverage of the legislation, which is going to mean that the door is closed to any future soccer players?
That's why I invited you onto the show, because, you know, advocates such as yourself who are, you know, on the ground talk about things that are simply not looked at in the mainstream media.
No, quite so. And that's one of the good things about the program is there's an opportunity to raise some of the things that don't get covered otherwise. And, we need to lift the lid on the hypocrisy of those who are in control.
I know you've got to leave soon, but are you able to briefly comment on the background to the Iran war?
Yes, a little bit, I guess. It's pretty clear, I think, that it's obviously, it's an extension of the way in which the US has supported Israel in terms of the genocide in Gaza, the bombing of Lebanon, then the bombing of Syria, the bombing of Iran, which the US collaborated with, and now I think you're seeing a twin example. So I think the US sees the opportunity of actually being able to eradicate in their mind someone that they see as an economic and political competitor in the Middle East. The US has been desperately trying to create the Abraham Accords with Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, the UAE, all the Gulf states to try and get an agreement between the US, Israel, and the Arab states, in the region. And that's the only way I think you can understand what the US is doing in Iran. They want a compliant regime, in Iran, in the same way they tried to enforce a compliant regime in Venezuela, and now are certainly looking at similarly trying to create a compliant regime, in Cuba. But the price that's being paid in Gaza, absolutely horrific. What are we up to now? 1,700, 1,800 dead in Iran. Proportionately, there are even more being, massacred by Israel, in Lebanon. But I think we're looking at a piece of, the US imperialism really trying to establish itself as the major player, to establish Israel as its, a loyal ally, in the Middle East. Whether it's the people in Iran, of Lebanon and Gaza have already paid such a horrific price, we're likely to see, with the world economy, actually made even more drastic consequences for people in the rest of the world. And the fact that Australia has given political support for it, Albanese, I think, a few weeks after he welcomed Herzog into Australia, has now was one of the first cabs off the rank actually supporting Trump's bombing, and now sending troops and some big surveillance plane to the UAE. So it's really, I think, a disgraceful situation that we've got Australia under a Labor government heavily implicated, totally implicated, complicit with the genocide, and now with the bombing of Iran, Lebanon.
Yeah, this could have been handled a lot more diplomatically.
Totally. They could have started with Albanese not supporting the bombing and being very, very clear that Australia wouldn't cooperate in that bombing. And the fact they continue to deny the connections, even though it's very well known and becoming increasingly better known that that Pine Gap is routinely providing intelligence for the US and Israel for the genocide and bombing in Gaza and Iran.
We have about a minute left before we need to finish this, but are you able to quickly advertise the rally organised by Stop the War on Palestine?
I just heard you've got a bit of a segment later about the globalised arrest in Queensland over the banning of globalised intifada and from the river to the sea in Queensland. The Minns government is attempting to do the same thing in New South Wales, and Stop the War on Palestine has got a rally 6 o'clock outside the New South Wales Parliament. Tomorrow, Tuesday the 17th, 6 o'clock outside the New South Wales Parliament, saying, no ban on political slogans. We need to globalise the intifada. We need to support the slogan. More importantly, I think we've actually got to extend the struggle. We need an intifada in Australia. We need an intifada in the West.
Ian, thank you so much for coming onto the program. Lovely to have you, and we'll talk soon.
Okay, thanks very much, Marissa.
Thanks a lot. Take care. And that was Ian Rintel from the Refugee Action Coalition, speaking to him about a number of things, namely about refugees and asylum seekers being given fair passage and looking at violations of human rights. And just wanted to say also that presently we will be joined by Uncle Kelvin Brown, who is on the Mole Creek Committee, speaking and having a yarn with us about what's been going on with campaigns, in particular looking at not only Mole Creek, but also looking at Palestine in solidarity with First Nations movements.
Melbourne, we are stronger together. Join with unionists, people of faith, young people and refugees to affirm the strength of our diverse communities. We all need to feel a sense of belonging and be assured of justice and fair treatment. Come along to Stronger Together, Palm Sunday, 29th of March. Gather on Prince's Bridge at 1 p.m. with banners and placards, then walk to Birrarung Mar Lower Terrace. There'll be speakers and music from 2 p.m. We walk to embrace and celebrate our differences, say no to all cruelty and injustice, and stand up for freedom and peace. See you on the bridge. Stronger Together, Palm Sunday the 29th of March from 1 p.m. Search for Stronger Together on Facebook for more information. Refugee Advocacy Network is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, Doing Time Show, 855 AM on the dial. And joining us, I'm delighted to welcome Uncle Kelvin Brown. And we'll be yarning with him very soon. Hello, Uncle.
Yeah, Yama Gamba Ninda. How are you,
sis? I'm okay. We have to stay positive, isn't it, Uncle?
That's right, my darling, yes.
Yeah. So, first of all, can you just tell us what land you're from?
Right, I'm Gamilaroi country, which are up here. It's either Gamilaroi, Yellowri, and all of that sort of stuff. But I normally just go with Gamilaroi, which is the language structure that I've been taught and been exposed to most of my life. And so I go with Gamilaroi. Now, that's just above Wiradjuri, and just, it's more towards northwest New South Wales.
Beautiful. It's always good, isn't it, to have, Aboriginal people look at the land and talk about, where they're from. That's so important, isn't it?
Oh, well, it's part of our being. It's part of our presence. It's part of our spirit. Of course we're going to do that sort of thing. And a lot of people sort of like think about the way that we look at land and say, if you're not an Aboriginal, we don't understand your relationship and belonging to the land. And I said, well, if you can imagine that a farmer and his people, his family have been on a bit of land for, say, 100 years or more, and then all of a sudden they lose it and they feel heartbroken by it. Well, that's how we felt when we lost our land many years ago under the colonisation of the nation. But the thing is, once they see that happen to them, then they have more of an understanding of what's happened to us. But they just don't understand it per se, straight up to say, we don't understand what you mean by belonging to land or just, acknowledging that you are not so much an owner of a land, you are a custodian of it.
Exactly. So, yeah. Uncle, you and I were having a really interesting conversation off air today about Palestine and First Nations communities. And I know you wanted to talk about Mabo and Palestine. Yes, can you talk about that?
Well, it's not so much Mabo. It's more like about the movement in regards to native title and the processes involved.
Perfect.
Yep. Now, what happened was a number of years ago when the Israeli government said they wanted to reclaim land that was on Palestinian aspect of it, but they were going to come along and say, all right, now we're going to take this land, we're going to turn it into farmland, we're going to do this, but that's not your land, that's Palestinian land. And so, therefore, when they turned around and said, all right, well, you can take support if you want, but we're taking the land regardless. And so a number of people were thinking, well, how has this happened before in other places where land has been taken from? First of all, it happened here in Australia, it happened in Canada, it happened in North America, which is the US, and so forth in regards to Native Americans, Canadian and natives, and, of course, Aboriginal Australians here in Australia. And it wasn't, you know, the island people, which is the murder. And so what we got there is this idea of saying, well, if this has happened, what did those people do? And so the Palestinian government, or elements of it anyway, looked at the ideology of native people and, you know, Mabo legislation and so forth, and, you know, how that process was developed and what the outcomes were. Well, here in Australia, of course, Mabo absolutely had a big impact, and native title has also had a big impact across the nation as well, because we have, you know, aspects of our land that we're still trying to fight to get back, but other aspects of our land we have gotten back. Only about 5 years ago, there's a great big mountain halfway between Inverell, where I live, and up in Armidale, here in the northwest in New England, and it's white man's name is Mount Yarrowick, but we call it what happened was this, we got the land back, but it took us 7 years of fighting to do it. But the process that were involved, which is the land environment court and all of that sort of stuff. And what we did was we turned around and we said, we won't give up. Because that's the thing about these things, is that the court systems make it very, very hard for you to keep moving forward. And you've got to do that to make sure you get there in the end. So it took us 7 years, but we got there. And eventually that land was given back to us under native title. And now we're in the process of, you know, doing a management system to look after it, cater to the needs of the country, the land that we utilised and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And so when the Palestinians were looking at what's happening over there, they wanted to use the same process and said, look, it's long, it's slow, it's tedious, and it's disheartening, because the court system's designed in a way that will make you think twice about, one, attempting it, two, that it is long and ongoing and you can't give up. And that's one of the ways that these court systems are geared, is sometimes they don't just take, say, a few years, but, you know, like us, for 7 years in other cases, there are still cases that have been pending. It's been there for well over a decade, easily over a decade. And so displaced people's land is a big way of looking at things in regards to acquisition of land to reclaim it back into a First Nations sort of like relationship and the custodianship of it. Because I don't like to use the word own, because we don't own any land at all. We are custodians of it. But the Palestinians looked at this, and my understanding is that they would like to go down that path of land reclamation under an auspice that would be very similar, if not the same, as native title or Mabo.
Wow. I mean, that would be amazing if that could happen.
Mm.
But there's so much imperialism, though.
Yeah, it's but there's also a sense of entitlement that when people take something from you, if they hold it for long enough, they feel entitled to keep it. Yeah. And that's basically what happens with a lot of First Nations people, that they get put into a place where it has been taken for them so long that, well, even though they feel it, they've still got engagement with the land, they can't really get anywhere with it because of the fact that this other entity has come along and said, no, we own that now. Sorry, you can just leave. We'll take care of all of this. I said, but that's our land. Why would you want to take our land off us? And so it's rather a sad statement that some people just take so long and it's so tedious that people just give up. And I think the court system has been geared that way.
Yeah. So you've been thinking about this a lot in terms of yourself as well?
Well, when we got our land back, you know, like Mount Yarrowick and all of that sort of stuff, like I said, we put the first processes and we had to speak to people within community to say, all right, listen, mob, if we're going to do this, we're going to do like a class action, everyone should sign up. It can't be just individuals that will come along and just ad hoc. We need as many people as possible to come along and put their names to this to be signatories. And so I remember this going back easily 10 years ago. My two lovely, beautiful sisters who have since passed on, we all turned up over at one of these registration days to say, yes, we want to see about getting our land back, which is Mount Yarrowick. And then what happened was that first processes sort of like put into place. All that information was taken by the registrar and then formalised. But they said, no, we need to go and do more. And so they started to expand the base of saying who is involved and what's your relationship to the land, what's your storylines, what's your songlines, so forth, and relationships. And then we did another sign-on, which expanded that original base of application, and then it grew to a point, say, right, now we've got the numbers. Now we can really go forward. But the moment you put in those claims to say that you want this land back, that's just the opening part. Then you've got to go back and forth again. Their side of the argument's got to be listened to, our side of the argument's got to be listened to. That's going to happen quite a number of times. And then you have to have formalisation of it by way of saying, all right, if this land was given back to you, what would you do with it? How would you manage it? What is the trust of it? And you've got to formalise that as well, because this is part of a white man's speak. But having said that, it is understandable too that if you're going to get something back, you've got to be utilised in a way that's going to be useful for all of our mob, not just some of our mob. And that's one thing that I've always said to our people, which is, if we're going to do this, it's got to be for everybody. It can't be family groups, it can't be fan groups or anything else like that. It's got to be all of us that are part of that song line or where that land has been acquisitioned from that you're trying to reclaim.
Yeah, it's really good, Uncle Kelvin, that you've been able to talk about it, because a lot of the time it's too painful, isn't it, for First Nations people to talk about this stuff?
Yeah, well, see, the thing is, as I just iterated, that original sign-up day that we had here in Inverell, it was me and my two sisters. Now it's just me. My two sisters have since passed on. But they both had the ideology to say, yes, we've got to do this. It's the right thing to do. It's a needful thing to do. But everyone knew it was going to be hard and all of that sort of stuff. Now, sadly, one of my sisters passed away before we got that land back, okay, and the other one was still alive when we got the land back, but she only managed to go and visit it once. And then sadly, she's moved on. But me, I'm still there. I'm still part of it. I'm going to seek to be put on the management committee that looks after that land acquisition that's been returned to us. But that's what we call it. We call it return. And we like to see, make sure that it's there, utilised by our mob, our community, not just individual people, not family groups or anything else, not clans, the tribal people, definitely. But remember that there are different tribes in some of these places. Now, this Mount Drowry, it was, Gamilaroi, but it's also Darkinjan people and so forth. They are also a claim, and then the Anawan people and so forth. And we had to collectively make sure all of these people were able to say, well, can we have our say in this? And I said, of course you can. We're not going to stop you from doing it. But remember, you've got to be there for all of us, not just for some of us.
Was it a court battle, Uncle?
It was. It took a long, long time. Yeah, well, you go through land and environment court and so forth, and then it's back and forth for years and years and years. And, of course, every time that you go through, if an argument's put up on either side, it's got to be explored. That argument's got to be explored. And then you've got to have a return back on that, and other people seek information to support that argument. Once that's done, then you come back and you say, now the outcomes of that is this. Now we can move forward to the next stage and so forth. And it's all staged out until you get finally to a point where they say, yes, we're going to give you back the land, or no, we're not. And they give clear evidence of why that is going to be one way or the other. In our case, if it's successful, we got it back. And it was one of the largest pieces of land acquisition up in the north for many, many years.
And what does it look like now? What can you do moving forward now?
Right, well, there are certainly cultural spaces on that bit of land that we're utilising to our own benefit, but what we've done also is to say there are certain parts of it that can't be utilised because it's been there for, specific cultural purposes in this business or men's business or, other cultural businesses. Where other places that we can open it to the public can go through there and learn about the place and have an understanding of the belonging of the people that have relationship with land, the song lines and so forth. There's three trails on that mountain. there's the short one, the medium one, and the long one. And if you go the long one, you're up there for about 2 to 3 hours before you get the chance to come back. But if you want to go the short one, yeah, you know, you could go up there and back in about 45 minutes. But it is a large piece of land that we got back. It's probably around about 25 kilometres square. It's a fair parcel of land.
So this is in New South Wales, so-called?
Yes.
Wow, that's beautiful. I'm so glad that happened, Uncle Kelvin. That's awesome. Now, what about Mole Creek? Let's talk about that. I mean, I'll be doing a special broadcast on that in June. And in case listeners have just tuned in, what is that memorial? What's the significance of that memorial?
Okay. Now, there have been thousands upon thousands of incidents of massacres of Aboriginal people throughout the nation. Okay, Gondwana land, sorry, I'm concerned, that's what I like to call it.
Yeah.
When it comes to these sort of conversations, I don't like to call it Australia, I like to say Gondwana land. But these massacres or killings of Aboriginal people were by and large gone, some cases unnoticed because people just disappeared. In other cases, yes, there's clear evidence that people have been killed, they've exploded. In other cases where people have been poisoned, either by way of flour or by the way of sugar or by the way of something in their drink or tea or maybe a bit of wine or something like that, you name it. There have been many, many instances. But when it comes to justice for massacres in Australia, it was only once in the entire history, the shared history of Gondwana land, Australia, and that is the Mole Creek Massacre. Now, it had a combined death issue of about 28 people. That's men, women, children, including babies. Now, that's 28. When the incident occurred on the 10th of June, 1838, people knew about it and said, all right, well, we're talking about non-Aboriginal people here. I said, well, what are we going to do about it? This is horrible. This is incredible injustice. And so these white people turned around and said, we want to do something. And so they got news back down to the new governor at the time, which was Governor Gipps. And he turned around and he said, well, this is horrible. He said, no. He said, so he said to one of his police magistrates, a chap by the name of Denny Day, and he says, I want you to go up to the northwest, up to this place called Mole Creek. I want you to investigate this massacre and then, you know, make any arrests you can, collect evidence and so forth. And if we do have people that we arrest them, we'll put them through trial. And that happened. 11 of the people that committed that atrocity back in 1838 were actually arrested. The other one got away and sadly never ever brought to justice, but the other 11 were. In the first court case, it was sort of like 11 people responsible for the death of 28. And after a due time of going through the court process of, you know, like the defendants, their stay and say, no, we didn't do it, we didn't do it. You know, the prosecutor said, yes, you did, yes, you did. And the reasons why and all of that sort of stuff. Now, in that first instance, the magistrate turned around and said, okay, how does the jury find in this regard? And the response to that was, we find that in this case that the defendants are not guilty as charged, that they are responsible for the death of 28. And so they got away with it.
Yeah.
But they were basically rearrested, and because the magistrate from that first trial said, this doesn't sit well with me, I want to do a bit more. So we spoke to the Attorney General of the day, which is John Plunkett, and he says, how would you move forward if you wanted to do something else? And so John Plunkett thought about it. He said, all right, I want to go to another trial, but this time I'm going to go to the death of one, but by seven of the 11. Okay? He said, why seven? Because I've got enough evidence here to charge these seven as clear as possible, more clear than the others that were caught up in that arrest process. And what they turned around then and said, all right, okay, so we're doing seven people responsible for the death of one. Who is the one? And they said, well, remember when we went up to the to the north after the event, which was the massacre, and we collected evidence. We took witness statements and we arrested people. Well, some of the evidence we brought back, and they are the remains of a child, name unknown. And this is clear in the evidence, and it's clear also in the court proceedings that that was out declared. Child, name unknown. And so another court proceeding went forward, and then at the end of that second court proceeding, the magistrate turned around to the jury and said, OK, how does the jury find in this regard? And the jury turned around and said, well, the jury foreman stood up and he said, in this regard, we find that these seven men are not, once again, there's that word, not guilty as charged. And we've got the waiver twice. But about 5 to 10 seconds after the jury foreman stood up and said that they were not guilty, one of the jury people stood up and said, hang on, that's not correct. We, the jury, didn't say that they were not guilty. We said they were. Of course, the magistrate turned around to the jury foreman and said, well, hang on, explain yourself. Are these people guilty or not? And the jury foreman said, I apologise to the court, I misspoke, which is another fancy way of saying he told a lie, told a fib. He said, yes, we have found that in this case that the seven men are guilty of the death of one. So the magistrate had a few more words that he had to say to the jury foreman. He dismissed the jury and he turned to the defendant and said, all right, give Montreby a judicial process. We are now going to declare that you are guilty, and therefore I will not wait around and wait for a period of time before passing sentence. I'm going to pass sentence right now, which is that all of you will be taken from here to Hyde Park Barracks. You'll be detained in such time as some gallows can be made, and that in event you will be summarily executed. You shall be hung by the neck until you are dead. And that's what happened to those seven. Now, the other members that were part of that defence, they didn't get away scot-free. They were still incarcerated. They weren't let go, but they weren't executed. The other one that did get away, he went up into Queensland and was up to something, from what we understand by family records, he was up there for about 30 years, and who knows what sort of damage he did up there. We had no idea. But and he came back.
Yeah.
And then he actually died a very comfortable life. Never ever charged with any sort of judicial process at all.
So some people were acquitted, but most of them. So it's good that you're talking about the trial, in detail, because that massacre was pretty horrible. And they continued, for quite a long time.
Yes, right up into the
1930s, exactly. And it's really fantastic that there's an annual memorial on the site of the massacre in Mile Creek, and we'll talk about that more when the time comes. But that's in June, isn't it?
Yes, the June long weekend.
Uncle, it's so lovely to have you. I know you need to be somewhere, but thank you so much for coming onto the show today. It's always good to have a yarn.
No, it's always good to have a yarn with you, my sister. No problems at all. Anyway, you mob out there, take care. Yama gamba dinda, yalu. And take care, and we'll talk somewhere down the track.
Beautiful. Thanks, Uncle.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Take care. And that was Uncle Calvin Brown, who's just awesome. And he has done some amazing work on the Mile Creek Committee and is very committed to education as well in schools. And he talked quite a lot about the Mile Creek Massacre and also Native Title and some of the wins that have happened in so-called white man's law. But no, it is good that there has been something positive as well.
Forests are essential ecosystems, mitigating for climate breakdown, cooling the planet, and preserving the wondrous diversity of life. Yet, they are being destroyed at an alarming rate. Here in the Kulin Nations, logging continues, increasing risk of both fires and floods. The Bob Brown Foundation is calling a national day of action, the March in March for Forests. In NAM, join us on Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m. in Parliament Gardens to demand the protection for native forests. Go to marchforforests.org for all the details, including how to volunteer. March for Forests, Sunday the 22nd of March at 11 a.m.
A 3CR supporter.
Melbourne Food and Wine Festival hosts Feast for Freedom with the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre for one night only. Join us for an exclusive communal dining experience at the ASRC's Home of Hope in Footscray on Wednesday the 25th of March. Share a long table feast created by refugee chefs from Palestine and Sri Lanka. Celebrate incredible food and help raise vital funds for people seeking asylum. Tickets are limited. Book now at feastforfreedom.org.au/MFWF. Feast for Freedom is an initiative of the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, a 3CR supporter.
What if one meal could change someone's life? Host a Feast for Freedom this autumn at your home, workplace, or in your community, and cook delicious recipes shared by our hero cooks from Palestine and Sri Lanka. Bring people together over food and raise vital funds to support people seeking asylum. Register now and host your feast by the 30th of April at feastforfreedom.org.au. Feast for Freedom is an initiative of the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, a 3CR supporter.
Down to the river, I sat down on the bank. I tried to think, but I couldn't, so I jumped in and sank. I came up once and I hollered. I came up twice and cried. If that water hadn't been so cold, I might have sunk and died. But it was cold in that water, it was cold, it was cold in that water, so cold. I took the elevator 16 floors above the ground. I thought about my baby and thought I would jump down. I stood there and I hollered. I stood there and I cried. If it hadn't been so high, I might have jumped and died. But it was high up there, it was high, so high up there. So since I'm still living, I guess I will live on. I could have died for love, but for living I was born. Though you may hear me holler, though you may see me cry, I'll be doggone sweet, baby, if you're gonna see me die. Life is fine, fine as wine, life is fine.
You're listening to the Do and Time Show, 3CR Community Radio with Marissa. And you just heard a song by Paul Kelly called Life is Fine. It's approximately 4:44. It's just getting up to about 4:45 now. And I just wanted to, before I conclude the show, I wanted to read out a media release which will really expand a little bit on what was discussed on the first interview with Ian Rintel. And this media release was put out by Stop the War on Palestine, and it was entitled It's on the 16th of the 3rd, 2026, which is today. And Stop the War in Palestine will rally to oppose the Minsk government draconian plan to ban the slogan "Globalize the Intifada." As a protest, and the protest will take place at 6 p.m. if you're in New South Wales, Tuesday the 17th of March at New South Wales Parliament on Macquarie Street. The rally is timed to coincide with the first sitting day of the session of Parliament. Legislation banning the slogan is expected as early as next week. Rally speakers include Vince Corley, National Tertiary Education Union, New South Wales Division Secretary, Jenny Long, New South Wales Greens, Ethan Floyd, Wiradjuri Wellen and Ngunjatjikapa activist, and 2026 Global SMUD, and Flotilla participant was the other speaker. Katie Sharmus, Australia, Palestine Advocacy Network as well will be another speaker. Stop the War on Palestine spokesperson Adam says, "We've seen shocking arrests in Queensland for using the pro-Palestine slogan from the river to the sea. This is the pro-Israel censorship regime that Chris Minns wants to unleash on New South Wales. He will be fought every step of the way." He continued, "The Israeli Foreign Minister, Gideon Scar, has welcomed the Queensland slogan ban and called for it to be extended to other states. When representatives of a genocidal state are cheering on your policies, you are on the wrong side of history." Adam added, "Intifada is the Arabic word for uprising. Calling to globalise the Intifada means building global resistance to Israel's genocidal occupation. Our government is arming Israel with 35 parts and steel from Bizaloy in Wollongong. Intelligence from Pine Gap spy base is used for bombing Iran and Gaza. It is right to resist this. Trump and Israel are now unleashing even more terror across the Middle East with their attacks on Iran and Lebanon. Albanese and Min's support for Trump and Israel's criminal wars is the crime, not pro-Palestine slogans." So I wanted to actually read that out just to clarify what's going on. And yes, indeed, I will be doing a segment on what's happening in Queensland and the shocking arrests in the near future. So yeah, it was really important to actually read out that that media release. So if you can get along to the rally and you're in New South Wales, yes, please do so. But in the meantime, I'm going to be playing a song by Ruby Hunter, Women's Business.
Woman business in the home. Work my fingers to the bone. Woman business in the home. Woman business living alone. On the streets or in a home. She's a woman not alone. With her children
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
The state Labor government has begun works on demolishing Melbourne's 44 public housing towers to be replaced with private housing. Already hundreds of residents have been displaced, often into unsuitable homes under duress.
The towers on Racecourse Road, Flemington, have become Homes Victoria work sites, while the families still living in the buildings are being treated appallingly.
Join Save Public Housing supporters in solidarity with residents.
Weekdays 7:30 till 9 a.m. as we engage with passing traffic to make some noise and show Jacinta Allen
that the demolition of public housing is unacceptable. Signs and banners provided or bring your own.
There's power in numbers, so see you at 120 Racecourse Road, Flemington, 7:30 till 9 a.m.
Save Public Housing is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, doing time show 855 AM on the dial, and it also streams live, www.3cr.org.au. It's approximately 4:53 and we're just about to conclude the show, and I wanted to actually just draw attention to listeners. I just read out a recent media release that came out today from the Refugee Action Coalition, Stop the War on Palestine, and I was reading about the rally that's happening tomorrow. And I just wanted to read out some of the endorsements from that rally, some organisations that have endorsed it. So Palestine Justice Movement, Jews Against the Occupation, National Tertiary Education Union, New South Wales Division, New South Wales Young Greens, Sydney Uni, SRC, NTEU for Palestine, Students Against War, Teachers and School Staff for Palestine, Northern Beaches for Palestine, Central Coast for Palestine, Mountains for Palestine, Families for Palestine, Readers and Writers Against Genocide, Sydney Uni Autonomous, Collective Against Racism. So I wanted to read all that out just to show that, you know, we're not going away. And, you know, there are lots of organisations that have endorsed. So thank you, Ian Rintel, for coming onto the show. And also thank you to you, Uncle Kelvin Brown, for coming on for a yarn. And we're going to be going out now with our theme song, Black Fella, White Fella, by the Rumpy Band. A shout out to all marginalised communities. Shout out to also people in prison as well. And hit the streets. Bye.
As long as you are true fella, as long as you real fellow. All the people of different races with different lives in different places. It doesn't matter what your name is. We got to help. Lots of changes. We need more brothers if we're to make it. We need more sisters if we're to save it. Are you the one who's gonna stand up and be counted? Are you the one who's gonna be there when we shout it? Are you the one who's always ready with a helping hand? Are you the one who understands this family plan? Black fella, white fella, yellow fella, any fella, it doesn't matter what you color, as long as you are true fella. All the people of different races with different lives in different places, it doesn't matter which religions, it's all the same. Well, the ship is sinking. We need more brothers if we're to make it. We need more sisters if we're to save it. Are you the one who's gonna stand up and be counted? Are you the one who's gonna be there when we shout it? Are you the one who's always ready with a helping hand? Are you the one who understands this family plan?
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.